November the 6th. Like a path in autumn. Scarcely has it been swept clear when it's once more covered with dry leaves.
Hey, this is Swan.
And I'm Chris.
You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. So we've all survived the month of January, almost. By the time you listen to this, we will have survived. So congratulations on that. And
not a bad month.
Wasn't too bad. Mild winter.
Yeah.
In New York, we had, sure we what, like two cold days? It was fun working. I work outside, and so it was fun working during the storm blowing and just being like, the day is progressively getting worse and worse, being like, finally feels like winter.
You have to have at least a couple days of winter.
Yeah, it's required. Yeah. Like the blizzard last year. Yeah. That was a nice planned.
That was amazing.
Winter. Yeah, I was actually traveling, and Drishti, my dog, and I were down by the Bowery, and it was just like empty streets, so we started sledding on our feet, running around and sliding and running around and sliding, and cars can't drive, so the streets are like as safe as they're ever gonna be.
The city's pretty great when cars can't drive.
But I digress. Kind of in the spirit of things, I guess, we've been doing lots of lists of books, and we have yet another conversation involving lists of books.
I mean, people love lists and people love books, so it's a good combo.
Usually people that love lists love books, and people that love books love lists.
We know our market.
Damn it. And so this week I decided to talk about, I guess, the animals and the environment. And I was thinking about it and was like, oh, I happen to know someone who cares a great deal about both of those things. And happens to also be my co-host, so that was
and
convenient.
And boyfriend. That was super convenient.
So convenient. Here we are. So I'm going to start with the big guns. Chris, why should I care about the animals? And why should I care about the environment?
Well, they're all connected. That's the short answer. I mean, you know,
we have an hour here. Come on. Yeah. Give me something more than
that's,
that.
Let's do the
connected.
Long answer.
Oh. Really?
And we're done. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is Ink and Worm. Please check us out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's easy a lot of times to forget that humans are animals, but...
How? If you have hair... If you remove your hair, are you still an animal?
Plenty of animals don't have hair.
What if you sit in a sunbed and tan your skin? Are you still an animal?
Plenty of animals like to sit in the sun.
Okay. I have two disclaimers. I have my dog sitting next to me. You can't hear her. But if you start hearing somebody panting, it's my dog. It's not us.
We should have really set up a third microphone yeah. next to Drishti for the whole
so
hour.
She could get more and less excited. And the other disclaimer is I'm drinking a gin and tonic. Thank you for being understanding if you hear that happening. Like ice in a cup and swallowing sounds. I am an alcoholic. That's fun. Okay, so we're all connected. Animals, so like how am I connected to an elephant in Africa besides the fact that I like them?
I mean you think of the earth as essentially one huge ecosystem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so like you need all of, and that main ecosystem is made up of smaller ecosystems and all these different biomes over all over the place, so together, you know, the parts make up the whole. And so if you have equilibrium in all your ecosystems, you have a relatively stable earth.
But the history of the earth isn't stable.
Well,
so
yeah.
Isn't this just a new wave of instability?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between natural instability and human-produced instability.
You were talking about the geological timeline the other day. And it's really nice to look at. It's this giant scale, and you look at all of it, and it's like all these major events in the creation and development of the planet, and like this long line of things. And then right at the very end, it's like ancient humans, and then just right after it, modern humans. It's just like, just the last little bit in geological time. We're just little babies.
Yeah, my favorite graphic of that is some people have depicted the geologic timeline as a clock. And if I remember correctly, modern humans show up at like 30 seconds before midnight.
Right. Bam, we're here. Yeah. Changing
we
everything.
We just made it.
So I happen to know that you have a passion for a specific animal that roams the seas, deep ocean, and corals. So maybe you can speak to that. Why should the average Joe care about sharks?
Sure. Well, the average Joe likes to eat fish, right?
Loves it. Sushi's big, man.
Yeah, especially in New York. And so part of a healthy marine ecosystem is having apex predators.
But don't they eat the fish that we want to eat?
They eat some of the fish. but they also eat creatures that eat the fish. I mean, like seals and sea lions come to mind. And so, you know, if you want to lay out a little bit of logic here, figure if you got rid of sharks, then seal populations would explode. If seal populations exploded, then certain populations of fish would diminish or possibly even disappear. So you have things like that where, again, like everything's connected.
Complex systems.
Yeah, extremely complex.
The way I heard it also described is, I don't know that I can like put my whole self behind this person, but I did listen to moderately interesting talk by Ocean Ramsey, who is a woman marine biologist, and she's an advocate for sharks, but I feel like her voice is very social media-esque.
Yeah.
She caters to like sweeping statements and things rather than details. And for example, in her talk, her TED Talk, I'm being so critical, but in her TED Talk, okay. She talks about how the most influential thing being in her life is this great white whale, or great white whale, a great white
shark. Is this Moby Dick?
No. A great white shark, and that's kind of all she says about it. And I'm like, okay, if this being was so influential, can you talk about it? But long story short, TED Talk by Ocean Ramsey, she talked about sharks being the equivalent of the white blood cells of the sea. And for me, that really resonated because that made sense. They're these creatures that go around kind of cleaning things up, maintaining balances, you know, checking things out, just making sure everything is kind of like good.
Yeah, I mean, you have your... Trishy's giving lots of kisses. You have your weak marine animals and your sick marine animals, and you know, having a certain type of animal that sort of culls the seas and leaves just the healthy populations it's good for genetic diversity. It makes for happier seas overall.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, this dog might need to not be right next to us. That's her licking my arm. Okay, now that it's on tape, Drishti can go. Go. Keep going.
I mean, it's fitting to have an animal guest.
I know,
on
we
this
tried. She just isn't as good at conversation as we are.
Yeah, I felt like she was pretty quiet during that whole bit.
Pretty quiet, but also like oddly distracting.
Yeah.
She can't focus or something. So a little bit about animals. How about the environment? We hear all this stuff about climate change, carbon emissions. This doesn't seem to affect me that much. Why should I care about it?
I mean, the problem is it's a very gradual change. Like some environmentalists talk about this idea of having a pond with lilies on it, and if that population doubles every day, like, it's not for a long time, it's the pond's fine, right? But then suddenly there's a day that the pond is too covered by lilies, and then that suffocates the oxygen in the water, and then suddenly the pond's not fine. But it could have been fine the day before. And that's kind of the same with the Earth. We're fine. Yeah, these are very gradual changes. And especially if you don't live in an area that necessarily gets affected right away by those, then, like, you know, it could be decades until you as a human being really see strong effects of climate change. And so, I mean, if anything, the average human being won't notice it until it's too late.
Mm. So when it's affecting the masses, that it's like the tipping point has passed.
Yeah. You know, obviously right now you have a lot of communities that are already being affected. But the problem is these are mainly like island communities or coastal communities, mainly indigenous people, who don't necessarily have much power, and much of a voice in any kind of government. So like they're already feeling the effects today.
Right. I mean, people wearing masks. I hail from the land of the Great Salt Lake, where there is a huge problem with an inversion, and there's a lot of issues with pollution that gets stuck because of the way that the air flows over the mountain, kind of creates this bubble. And it was really interesting for me as an experience living there, because I was very sensitive to it, whereas other people, it's this gradual thing where, like, oh, the inversion is back. And I was like, I can't breathe. I can't walk. I don't want to live here anymore.
Yeah.
And health studies, which is like, you know, is on the political arena, they're being, a lot of scientists are retiring because they don't want to be attacked or, you know, whatever is a recent thing. But, there's been studies that prove air pollution is affecting elderly populations and infant populations and pregnant women in pretty substantial ways. So it's like things are starting to affect people en masse.
Yeah.
And especially depending on where you live. So.
Yeah, there's one of the things I came across last year was a revised map of Louisiana. You know, which is traditionally like this boot, right? But the thing is actually that the water has risen in so many areas that really that like main foot part of that boot is gone. And it's really just tendrils.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy. But that's not really well publicized because...
Yeah, these things don't get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
So we've kind of talked about a little bit. Let's dive into some books. Are there some books that come to mind for you related to like what we've been talking about, or just that are some of your favorites?
Yeah, I mean, I was I was brainstorming the other day thinking about, you know, what do I think of when I think of environmental books? Because obviously that can take so many forms.
Yes, indeed. And P.S., if you have any books that you love or that you want us to promote, make sure you email us, Ink and Worm, all lowercase, ink and worm, spelled out, @gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. That's all.
one of my favorite books I consider like environmental texts is Reading the Mountains of Home by John Elder. He is a well-beloved Middlebury College professor, and my alma mater is Middlebury, so I heard him speak a lot. And it's sort of just about his time, like, living in Vermont and sort of his interactions with the land around his home and going for hikes and whatnot.
Sounds highly specific, but interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing is, it's not, you know, Vermont doesn't have that, like, you know, usually when people think of like wilderness, they think more like epic American
Canada
West.
Or something.
Yeah, or like Grand Canyon or, you know, the Rockies or something that's like, you're like, whoa, this
very
is
very visually impactful and impressive.
Yeah, versus like Vermont's wilderness is a little more like, you know, it's mostly like small mountains and it could be like rolling hills and just like deciduous forests and whatnot. And so it's not.
It's lovely.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's lovely. And it's kind of, it's more like intimate than epic. And so I love just reading this book. You just, you know, he's just like going for these walks and he's just sort of musing on his like his connection to the land and the people that have come through Vermont in the past. And it's, I don't know, to me it's like encapsulates just like how relevant the environment is to humanity. Not in a,
It's the connection thing that you opened with, I think.
Yeah.
That's what you're speaking to.
Yeah. Less the like the whole like, oh, you know, if X happens to the forest, then like Y happens to humans. But more just like, you know, we're part of this land and this water, and we always have been, and you can't escape that.
That reminds me of like Edward Abbey, because I grew out west, so that was like the influence of like being in the land, interacting with the land, and caring about the land.
Yeah, that was one of the other books I had written down for this evening was Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey.
Solid. My friend Hannah, don't search too far for that. She was Edward Abbey for like I want to say Halloween, but I think actually in hindsight it was for a scholastic presentation. Like post, like I think undergrad she did a presentation on him as him.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So my first thought went to a book that was kind of a catalyst for me in moving from Salt Lake City to anywhere, honestly. I was like, okay, out somewhere. And then a way appeared to come to New York, and here we are. And now I have a radio show, and you guys just are thrilled, I'm sure. But the book was called This Changes Everything by Naomi Watts. Naomi Watts? I just looked it up, and now I can't. Naomi Klein. This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate by Naomi Klein. Also became a documentary, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Very depressing book to read. But as I was reading it, I felt like my affinity for the environment was not felt in Salt Lake by the population as a whole. And it kind of motivated me to move somewhere where at least like I had some voices that sounded like the ones in my head.
Yeah.
I don't know if I found that in Brooklyn. I think I have. But
there's some environmental presence.
There's some nice conversations.
Yeah.
But then we also live in a city, which is actually, cities are good for the environment.
Yeah.
A little overwhelming if you're easily highly stimulated. But putting the people all together saves the environment.
Yeah.
And mass transit. I remember this book also influenced my decision to get rid of a car. And it was the first time I had not had a car since I was 16.
Wow.
And so that was kind of a scary thing, but it was nice. I had a boyfriend that let me borrow his car when I needed it. And then also afterward, just like not having a car, you figure it out. Like you are not. Oh, and big surprise, you have 2 feet.
Whoa.
I know. So I mean, it sounds really stupid, but it was actually quite liberating to be like, wait, if I want to go somewhere, I can just walk there. And that's a stupid thing to realize maybe because like, you know, even a 5-minute trip to the grocery store, you're like, oh, I need my car because I'm carrying groceries. And you're like, or I could just get less things and put them in a backpack and walk there. So for me, not being from a city and being out west where things are farther apart and you do have to make plans, it was a really scary thing for me to get rid of my car. But then as soon as I did it, I loved biking. And then I had a lot of animosity towards cars because it's really easy to get into this bubble when you're in a car and none of the like the rest of the world doesn't exist and it's just you and your car and fuck everyone else.
and definitely see a lot of that in New York.
You see that in New York and people, you know, honking and, you know, it's an outlet for rage maybe, but it's also really isolating. Not very many people carpool.
I
think that cars inherently isolate people, which makes you less connected with your environment and the people around you. Subway is another story. It's a different sort of isolation.
It's almost swinging to the opposite side of the spectrum.
I wonder, do you know if there's any city that has like a social subway? I think the rule is like don't talk, don't touch.
I mean, you know, I've been on subway systems across the US, Europe, Asia, and it's
just
always
like we're all going somewhere just like mind your own business. I mean, I've had some nice conversations on the subway, but they're always rare. And I feel like the few times that I try and engage with people, they're like, yes, leave me alone. Like, why are you talking to me?
It's the New York way, for better or worse.
The other book I wanted to bring up in relationship to this, because it came to my mind and was also really influential, is Bicycle Diaries by David Byrne, which is kind of like a overview of bicycle culture and the experiences and mindsets that come with a bike versus car. And then the limits of a bike, which kind of in some way are refreshing. You can only carry what you can carry. You can only go as far as you can go, you know, each day. So it was nice to read it. And also just his experiences of biking all over the world. He had a folding bike that he would bring with him. And he would just, you know, David Byrne shows up at this random place on a bike and like...
Ta-da!
And experiences follow.
Sounds like an interesting book.
Yeah, I had fun reading it, which is always nice. Some books aren't fun, especially books about animal rights and the environment. Sometimes aren't fun. Like, This Changes Everything, great book. I wouldn't say it was fun to read.
Not a summer read.
not really a beach read, lighthearted, hanging out.
I was just thinking, though, that bikes are, I mean, they're not isolated from the environment, but you're still kind of isolated from other people.
Unless you're tandem or like a wagon bike.
Yeah. I don't know, just a thought.
Bicycle. Unicycles.
That's a whole nother.
It's also very isolating. Don't touch me!
Also because then everyone's like, wait, you're on a unicycle?
Yeah, what are you doing? I saw a guy on his phone walking his dog on a unicycle, and I was like, oh, I feel like this is going to end badly soon. And his dog was pulling him, too. So I was like, oh. What do you... or the... tall bikes.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen those? That's a whole nother dance. Those are isolating.
Yeah. I'm so much higher than everyone else.
Well, I mean, in one sense, you are more visible and therefore safer. Nobody's going to run into
you.
That's
true.
They can see you.
Yeah.
As opposed to a regular bike, which I think is part of the movement, is just like bike visibility of like, we're here, share the road with us.
Yeah.
Kind of a concept, which is also carries over in cars. I remember I was stranded once, and then my, oh my God, is this necessary? Okay, and then my adopted sister's dad happened to be driving by, and he had an insanely tall truck.
Okay.
And for the first time in my life, I was driving down the highway, because he rescued me and drove me home, the same height as the semis.
Oh,
and was like,
weird.
I feel safe. I feel like I can see everything. Yeah. I feel like no one's going to mess with me. So that was kind of strange. Like lifting your elevation maybe sometimes makes you feel more empowered.
Sounds like the ape in you.
probably such an animal.
Yeah, see? Can't escape your roots.
All right. Ancient humans. 1230. Like 12, wait.
30 12, seconds of midnight.
1259:30.
Yeah.
for me, it's like 1259:59.
Hey, it was one.
Hi, 1 second. Bye.
As long as you get in your 1 second.
My 1 second in the geological history of the planet. What are you going to do with your 1 second? Ah, it's gone.
Dang it. I didn't have time to think about it.
No pressure.
Shoot.
Any other books that come to your mind that you're excited to talk about today?
Yeah, I was thinking about, you ever read any Bill Bryson books?
I'm so ashamed. I've tried.
Get off the show.
I've tried multiple books multiple times, and I haven't finished anything by him. I don't know. Maybe it's not compelling to me right now.
You just don't like his voice.
I honestly can't put my finger on what it is even because honestly, part of me is frustrated because people that I know and love and I would love to consume the media that they consume, and I know for a fact that they were heavily influenced by Bill Bryson. And that makes me want to read him so bad. And I've tried. And I haven't. I have yet to finish a book by Bill Bryson. Maybe I should try an audiobook. Sometimes that helps me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it has to be the style of writing. Because, I mean, having read a couple of his books, like, you definitely would like the content.
I know. That's the thing. I read overviews. I read reviews. I'm like, this seems like my thing. Yeah. Why is it not my thing?
I don't know.
Maybe there's not enough smooching.
You need some smooching.
Yeah. You can always use a good smooch.
Well, Bill Bryson book that I like a lot, a lot of people have read, is A Walk in the Woods.
That's one of the ones I started. So I could talk about the first 10 pages.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, well, I think it's a really great environmental book because you have someone... So, I mean, it's about him trying to walk the Appalachian Trail, right?
Oh.
And so you have someone who's sort of approaching the environment as a lot of humans would, which is like, this is not a regular part of my life. You know, I drive around in cars. I sit in my house.
Is it similar to Wild by Sheryl Strayed?
Yeah, I mean...
I feel like that's a common trope. Let me do the Appalachian Trail and then write about it.
Yeah, I would say Bryson sort of started it, and then...
Really? You would say he was the first, like, widely read author to do...
I think so.
I think that's
Could
fair.
Be wrong, but... Because his was in late 90s, I want to say. Maybe 2000.
And then it kind of hit a wave.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's really great because it's not... You know, it's definitely someone who's like, I'm not necessarily super comfortable in this, in this case, in the environment of the Appalachian Trail, but I'm giving it a shot. And, you know, I mean, he like learns a lot along the way and definitely gets more in touch with nature. And obviously he chose a particularly brutal version. You know, Appalachian Trail is not easy for anyone, but I do think it's really, like, I think it is a really great lesson, just that you know, getting out of your like human comfort zones and back into the natural world can seem really frightening.
Oh, it's very daunting, and I can especially see that having been west, where it was really accessible and I would hike every day and I'd go backpacking and camping on a very regular basis. And coming here, it's so much easier to maintain a detachment, and then it becomes overwhelming, which I think is why people don't care. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at the
end... don't know, you don't care.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of the day, like, humans like comfort, right? And so...
Yes.
You have your house or apartment, and it's warm...
You have your friends and your restaurants and...
Yeah. Or especially, I mean, these days, museums. You don't even you have your computer by which you access everything. And
you
so
never even have to leave your house. Yeah. You can work from home, order your food from home, order your, you know, clothes. You can even order your friends from your phone.
Yeah.
Hey, baby, come over.
Swipe, 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 swipe.
Swipe, 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 swipe. Instead of shots. What's this? I can't get the rhythm right now.
Swipe, swipe, swipe,
swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe, swipe.
Everybody.
Or it could be like, because like left is reject, right is I choose you. So it's like left, 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 right. Everybody.
I think we're on to something.
It's like my dating life. I'm like, nope, 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 nope. You.
Yeah.
Good job.
I lucked out. But I will say we at least, even though we worked through an online dating app, it was about meeting in person. So we didn't just stay.
And not hooking up.
Yeah. And we went to the aquarium.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was great.
That was appropriate.
Now we talk about the environment on a radio show.
Wow. How the places you can go. The other book by Bill Bryson that I tried, and I didn't, but I tried multiple times, is A Brief History of Everything.
Ooh, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, most people do. I can't I can't have an opinion. I didn't finish it. Oops.
Yeah, I mean, I think that book, I mean, I think Bryson's really great in all his books at bringing the almost the casual observer of the environment, if you will, into the natural world more in a way that's just
if you don't want to go outside, you can read about going outside and still like feel that.
Yeah, and at least, you know, learn a little more about the natural world and also just be like interested and excited by it and maybe even ultimately be curious about it and want to make your own steps. And I think that's really important. And to some extent, I almost feel like those kind of books are more relevant than the book, than like the nonfiction book that's like the environment.
Like,
is in
here's
trouble.
The facts.
Yeah. I mean, like, you need those too.
No, I think you have to be moved. You have to feel things. And maybe that's part of the problem is we're moving, we've moved from a society that is like interacting with, you know, dirt and plants on a daily basis to a society that sometimes your first few years of life could like be inside a building.
Yeah.
And like you just don't care if you've never, you know, gotten dirty and played in the, or like, you know, seen an owl, for example.
Yeah.
Why would I care about owls? But then you like see it flying and you see it moving and interacting with this environment and it moves you and then you care. I want you to talk, Chris, about your favorite books, book, one of your favorite books about sharks, Blue Meridian.
Oh, yeah.
As a person who has not read it.
Sure. Yeah, so this is Blue Meridian by, I'm going to mess this up, Peter Mathiesen. We'll put it in the notes, get the spelling right.
Or I can look it up while you start talking.
Yeah, so, I mean, Peter Mathiesen, he's a great nature writer, and Blue Meridian was about the search to film great white sharks for the first time.
Did they use a cage?
Yes, they did.
There you go. For those who are curious.
Yeah, so this was in the 1960s. And it's
Mathiesen? That's got to be how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
It's Mathiesen. 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 I don't know.
Yeah.
We tried.
It's okay. Again, we'll put it in the notes if you want to borrow it from your local library. So, yeah, it's kind of funny to think about now because...
it's like a thrill. It's like skydiving. Oh, I'm going to go cage diving with great whites.
Yeah. You know, like that's a thing that, I mean, anyone who has a spare couple thousand dollars can do. And then if you don't, like, you know, you can go online or watch television and like there's tons of imagery of great white sharks.
You have a website. It's not live, but it has a video.
Oh, yeah.
Chris was in grad school, we'll talk about that later, and created a website, and his like co-creators of the website found some links for him while he was doing all the coding. And the links they found were like a little bit sensational, which is funny. But one of them was this shark like flips up and obviously by accident goes into the cage and is like thrashing around and then like thrashes its way out of the cage. And then you're like, oh my God, that person is dead. And then the person comes out and you're like, they're not dead. And it's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Hazards of cage diving with great whites is sometimes they might flop into the cage.
I mean, that's a pretty rare incident. Pretty rare. Say.
And they're using chum to like trick them into a frenzy, which can be exciting.
Yeah, if you draw the chum too.
We just. Oh, sorry.
I was just gonna say, if you draw the chum too close to the cage.
Yeah, it's a natural consequence.
Yeah, because sharks' eyes roll back when they open their jaws as protection. For their eyes against, you know, prey potentially scratching them. So they're essentially blind at that last moment.
Yeah, blind before the bite. We just also read a shorter read that's nice about sharks. Maybe we should call this the shark show.
I'm okay with that.
It was, what was it called? Hunt for the Great White?
I think it was just The Great White Shark Scientist, actually.
Yeah. Straightforward title. It was really nice. It was by one of my favorite authors, Cy Montgomery, and I really like her. She wrote a book about octopuses is the official.
Octopi works too.
It works, but like the official isn't that. And I really enjoyed that. So I also really enjoyed this in the sense that it's kind of, you know, it's factual, but it's also personal for her. It's her experiencing this thing, this world. And she talks about, you know, cage diving and how her experience was like not fear at all. She was expecting to be afraid, but as soon as she saw the shark, she only felt the sense of calmness. And they used chum, and even with the chum, like the shark was very aware, very interested, very deliberate. It wasn't this like creature that was like, oh, I smell blood, I want to find it and
kill
eat
all
it.
The humans.
Yeah, like eat the blood. Like it was like, hi, what are you doing here? Like, and for me, that was kind of a powerful thing to just hear somebody, you know. You actually dove with sharks as well, and I feel like you had a similar experience where you were really nervous, but then as soon as you saw it, it was like, oh, I'm home.
I was actually pretty excited the whole time.
Oh, pretty excited. No nerves?
No.
Not even one?
Nope.
Oh, God. I'd be nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I think great environmental books do that where, like, they
help reframe, which I think is like a psychological process that you undergo anytime you get new information. You kind of reframe your world around it.
Yeah, if you're open-minded.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's the power of books, especially in this area where, like, you know, maybe
you might not be able to go cage diving with a great white, but you can read about it.
Yeah.
And still be moved.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the nice thing about Blue Meridian as well, is like, I mean, it sounds like it could potentially be dramatic. You know, you're like hunting for a great white shark. Yeah.
We're going to see them.
But really, it's a very, I don't want to say peaceful adventure, but it's definitely like cool and collected. And when they finally see the great whites, it's not a moment of great drama. Just transcendence.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. And like, this is a great moment. And we put in all this time and effort, and it was worth it to be here.
For some reason, that translates for me to an experience I had, which is so random. Forgive my randomness. This isn't a book. This is personal. So if you want to like fast forward a couple minutes and get back to the books. So I was at Rainbow Gathering, which is like a hippie gathering that's been happening for quite a few years. And we were up in Washington at this park. And I remember being barefoot and running on this mud that the closest thing I can relate it to is it's kind of like stepping onto a stomach and then it would kind of bounce you out. And I just remember being so present in this moment and being like amazed that people didn't actively seek out this experience and just like in awe of the fact that I was even having it, because it was kind of strange that I even arrived at this party per se. And I feel like that's something of the like quote unquote hippie movement that maybe lost a lot of traction really fast, was just like going out into the middle of nowhere. I mean, there's Burning Man, that's like,
I feel like that has nothing to do with the environment though.
Yeah, it's like build a city, take it away, which is nice. Like you can have a city for 2 weeks, is it? And then it disappears and like no harm, no foul. It's just dust like it was before.
Except there tends to be a lot of garbage afterwards.
People pick it up. And the same thing with Rainbow Gathering, which I honestly wished I could have stayed, because they have the big gathering. All the people come. All the people are interacting with the environment. And then a small group of people stay and they put in little seedlings and they bury everyone's shit and they clean up everyone's trash and like restore the space, which is like cool.
Yeah.
I think that would have been my favorite part had I been able to stay. I'm like, oh, let's plant these plants. Oh, let's wander around and find all the bud. Like, well, it's interesting. The Rainbow Gathering, they don't allow alcohol.
Oh.
So as like a big party, that's a major ingredient for most people. So to have a party that doesn't welcome it was interesting. There's other drugs, obviously. But
yeah.
Rainbow Gathering is going to be something.
Yeah, I figured.
But I think that was interesting for me too, just because I had been to a lot of festivals and like shows and concerts and whatnot that have lots of booze. That's why people go.
Yeah, so of course.
Anyways, this is so tangential. If you want to read more about that, you can read, I don't know.
I have nothing. No books on hippie gatherings?
I'll write a memoir for you. Swan at the Rainbow Gathering.
My time in the mud.
My time in the mud. But that was, I mean, for me, that was like a moment of presence, which I think if you go outside, you'll find that. I mean, I have like 5 other experiences pop up. One of them was just like being in close proximity to a moose by surprise. And we're like, oh, there's a moose right there. And I mean, it happens. If you go outside, it happens. I think these just moments of being completely present and completely, I mean, there's like a energetic fusion that happens and you're like, oh, I am one. I am connected. I am part of everything. It's like the Beatles. I am you and you are me and we are all together.
Yeah, cuckoo. Or Buddhism.
Cuckoo, cuckoo. Or Buddhism. Buddhism is a little bit more mellow and scientific in their approach.
Hey, whatever works to get people outside. Yeah. I don't care if it's Buddha or the Beatles.
Take your friends outside. Find the wonder of a caterpillar. Okay. So my next book is that cheating if I tell you what book to talk about and then talk about my own book?
Nope, that's fine.
Okay. This book is a book that I've started but haven't finished because it's not due back yet, but it's due back in a couple days. So it's on like the rush list. It's called The Global Guide to Animal Protection. It has been edited by Andrew Lindsay, and it's about saving the animals and why it matters and how to do it. And it's really daunting and huge and academic, but that's nice. I mean, it kind of reconnects to the basic, why should we care? And if you do care, how can you translate that into actual impact? So if you're interested, it exists. I got it from the Brooklyn Library. It will be back there by the end of the week.
Sounds good. Sounds like something I might like.
Yeah, you better read it in a day.
Hurry.
I tried to renew it. Someone is that someone has it on hold. So awesome on you for finding this book and wanting to read it. But also, bully on you because now I can't renew it.
Yeah, no good.
Unless I want to pay fines and keep it as long as I want to keep it, which I'm not. So yeah. It's so funny, the urgency created by this relatively arbitrary, like, oh, you owe 7 cents a day if you don't. It's like, I don't want to pay that. Better return it.
Yeah.
Which means I better read it. And so inevitably, it will get read because it's due back.
Yeah, it is funny to have a, you know, part of the great thing about having a book is that you can enjoy it on your own time, you know, like you.
But I never do. If I, no, this is tragic confession, but it's real, guys. If I own a book, I don't read it. If I borrow a book from a friend or from the library, I will read it because I know it's temporary and I have to return it. And all these books that I own, I guess I think that I'll get around to them eventually.
Yeah, like
which is weird because
book I bought you a year ago.
Because the books that I own are the books that I'm like, I want to own this because I think that I will love it and want to read it again and again and again. And then I don't even read it once. Oh, nonsense. Okay. Next, Jurassic Park. Really?
Yeah.
Jurassic Park is on your list. Will you please communicate?
Sure.
Okay, go.
So I had put, I mean, these kind of go together. I put Dune and Jurassic Park on my list. And the thing is, because they're both, you know, these popular science fiction books, right? But they also have, like, very strong environmental bents.
You could put Charlotte's Web on there.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Sorry.
I think our audience is mostly past Charlotte's Web.
maybe
not.
Email us, let us know. Oh, P.S. thanks for listening. If you just tuned in, this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you want to catch the rest of the show, we're on Audio Boom, iTunes, Stitcher, and I'm happy to communicate with you about books and writing at inkandworm@gmail.com. And also join the community of Radio Free Brooklyn. It's great fun. Lots of parties. Like Woo! Once a season.
But it's one really, really great one. Quality over quantity.
It's you know, having been to a few, they are great.
Yeah.
So, works of fiction.
Yeah, with strong ecological bends.
And Dune is known kind of as the book that defined science fiction as a genre in a lot of
it's definitely at this point a canonical text of science fiction.
Is canonical a word?
Yep.
Good job.
Thank you. Putting my liberal arts education to use. But yeah, I think books like these are really important because they reach more people than all the other books combined.
It's unfortunate, but true.
And like they're dealing with the environment in a very indirect manner. I mean, like in Jurassic Park's case, you know, on the surface is like, oh, well, this is about like cloned dinosaurs in a park. Like, okay, yes, but it's also a lot about bioengineering and also the ethics of bringing back species that have been extinct, and also like how much you can control animals,
wild things.
Yeah. And I mean, really the theme of Jurassic Park is that like you can't control nature. It breaks, like life breaks out and gets free.
I'm so immature. There's a song remix of Malcolm and his laugh. Did I send that to you?
I don't think you have.
The laugh where he's like, like, and it's a song remix of it. YouTube, Google it. You'll find it. Have fun. You're welcome.
Yeah. If you, I mean,
and Dune,
I mean, Dune, obviously, you know, it's, it takes place on, I mean, the eponymous planet's nickname is Dune. It's Arrakis is the proper name. You know, part of the book and like the Dune series as a whole is like terraforming this desert planet.
The potential to change it.
Yeah. But in the long run has a lot of negative changes and ultimately kind of, I mean, it kills the natural ecosystem of the planet.
Did you read more than one or the first?
I read them all.
Of course.
Yeah.
I just read the first one. I think just this last year.
Yeah.
I read Jurassic Park in high school. It was very thrilling. It's a very exciting book to read.
Yeah. It's filled with chaos theory, which...
But yeah, which was kind of surprising, but it wasn't distracting from the story.
Yeah, no, I mean, Michael Crichton, I always thought, was really good at blending like complex theoretical concepts with like seat of your pants action.
Go, Michael Crichton.
Yeah, rest in peace.
Yeah.
Do you have a next book?
I don't. sorry.
Oh, okay.
I was racking my brain a little bit, and then I stopped.
Oh, that's all right.
Because I'm looking at this long list of yours, and it's a little distracting.
Oh.
So you say one more book, and maybe I'll have one more by the time you're done.
Okay. Well, I mean, another one I was thinking about was Encounters with the Archdruid by John McPhee, which is... It's
fiction?
Nonfiction.
Oh.
It's sort of about, it's what, I want to say three or four different sections of the book, each one a different story, sort of about like man dealing with nature. Mm-hmm. And like, so for example, one is about a massive volcanic explosion in Iceland and... the like local village trying to, and the Iceland as a whole trying to figure out like how to divert the lava to protect the village. So each of these stories just deal with like man coming into contact with nature. And I mean, I really love it just because it shows just like how awesome, and I don't mean awesome as in cool. I mean, as like full of awe, the power of nature is, and that it really, I mean, the environment really can be like this incredible force, and also like a potentially very dangerous force.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you need to have respect for it. You don't need to fear it per se, but you need to understand that like the world is not just at humanity's feet.
Hmm. I think people exposed to the tsunami. Obviously, the gin is starting to take effect.
Yeah, so
but to tsunami. there was a movie about it. It was okay, but just like, even I mean, I think of living in Georgia during the time that I did, and there wasn't a huge hurricane that came through.
Yeah.
But after I moved away, Katrina came through, and then I went to clean up after that, and like walking into these spaces after nature had just been like boo, was like, wow, we are really at the mercy of it all.
Yeah,
like when this comes through, it's coming and you just have to leave.
Yeah, I think it's you know, humans all too often feel superior to the natural world, but really we're not. And like, you have to remember that as beings that are part of it, like we're just as vulnerable to its more destructive parts.
Do we have any books about ecotourism? Because I feel like we just snorkeled with manatees. We're so interesting. but it was a big push of like passive observation. And also we're saving these animals and doing all this research. And I have a couple of friends that are kind of either directly involved or peripherally interested in ecotourism. So I feel like I wish I had a book, because I feel like talking about having moving experiences, that's one way to get them is by going on something that's sustainable and supporting local communities and having an experience.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever come across any books about ecotourism.
All right, guys, shout out if you're listening and you know of any books on ecotourism. We're interested.
Yeah. But there are definitely a lot of great articles out there about ecotourism.
Mm-hmm.
And just like what kind of operators are out
scholarly
there.
Scholarly and otherwise.
Yeah.
Make sure your ecotourisms are actually ecotourisms.
Yeah.
I guess is the one recommendation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is ecotourism. You're like, well, this is a 5-star cruise ship. I don't know.
I'm iffy.
It doesn't quite translate for me.
I know. For a friend go to New Zealand recently, and she was like, can you help me find an actual ecotourism operator that swims with dolphins? She just felt like overwhelmed by all the BS online.
All right. Okay, quick rapid fire. You have one question. Go.
Favorite animal?
Favorite animal? Seal.
What kind of seal?
Gray seal.
Okay, nice.
Okay. You...
Great way to check.
Duh.
One animal you want to see the most?
The one animal I want to see the most?
Yeah.
Oh, good. In person, like without barriers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
What's the marsupial you just told?
Oh, the quokka?
Quokka.
Yeah, we highly recommend, if you've never heard of the quokka.
Quokka selfie. Guys, Google it. Yeah. Look at the images.
You will not regret it.
The one animal you're scared of? Anything?
I don't think anything.
Anything?
Yeah. I love everything.
Everything?
Yeah.
Nothing scares you. Spiders, snakes.
No.
Deep sea guys with lots of teeth.
They all sound great to me.
Oh my God. You're obnoxious.
Hey.
What is obnoxious? What are you scared of? Let's talk about this on the radio. And well, that's...
What about you?
Oh, what I'm most scared of? I am scared of spiders.
Okay.
If they seem easy to save, I will save them. If they start jumping around, I will squish them.
All right, that's fair.
Sorry. I always apologize. I recognize
it's good to apologize.
This is a cruel world. I was thinking it was interesting the other day. I've never been put off by moths.
Moths are great.
I've always preferred moths to butterflies, and I was never afraid of them. And I remember like being at like girls' camp growing up, and people would be like, moth! And I'd be like, wow, it's so ethereal and strange and mysterious.
Why would I be scared of something that's a fraction of my size?
It's like feathers.
Yeah.
Anyways, well, thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. We're on Audio Boom, Stitcher, and iTunes. Check us out. Leave us a review. We like to read them.
Yeah.
Email us, inkandworm@gmail.com. I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Successorate.